Hello.
Duncan Reel 2. We were talking about Bovington, and I was just trying to get some of your impressions of what it was like in 1920 when you first went there. I imagine that the mess must have been quite a colourful sight, given the mix of regiments who had officers seconded to the corps.
Yes, to some extent, not really. Everyone was in khaki. Really, only people like myself who came from a Scottish regiment, or one or two cavalry officers, who produced any other change from universal khaki. I wore nothing else. See, no, blue hadn't come in those days.
Your ambition had been to go into tanks in the event you were seconded to an armored car company. Was that a disappointment or a gratification?
No, I was seconded to the tank corps. So to that end, I achieved my part of my aim, because it was quite clear even at that time, we see that the tank corps were going to run both armored cars and tanks, as they continued to do right up to 1937. See, all the armored car companies in India were all tank corps.
The period at Bovington, did they give you any kind of formal, structured kind of training on armored cars and or tanks?
In 1920?
Yes.
No, absolutely none. Absolutely none whatsoever. The only training we got was in the general soldier's skills, foot drill. It's extraordinary to look back on. We received no mechanical training at all, of any kind. And when we actually sailed, a very scratch collection of officers and an equally scratch collection of men, I and one other chap were the mechanical experts of the company. We both had motorbikes, and we both had successfully taken the cylinders off and decarbonized them and put them back in, and they went afterwards. But that was the sum total of the mechanical knowledge of the Fourth Armoured Car Company when it left. It could shoot, it could drill, it was passably administered. It wasn't very well done. The men had been trained in map reading. They'd had fragments of military history, very sketchy because there were practically no histories of the Tank Corps available at that time. They'd done PT. We shot revolvers with which we were armed. We shot rifles, and I think, as far as I remember, we had one or two Vickers guns, which he'd just begun to look. And we went out in a troop ship. We got to Alexandria, and after some time, three Rolls-Royce cars arrived.
But there were armoured cars at Bovington. Had you had no training on those?
No, no armoured cars. There were no Rolls armoured cars at Bovington at all. There were Pearlys, but the armoured car wing was virtually non-existent. And it wasn't until 1920, somewhere between 1922 and 1924, that the armoured car wing as such became a separate part of Bovington. There were some models, there were some section models of tank engines, but nobody gave us any instruction on that. And we really taught ourselves on arrival in Egypt.
So not even with the Pierce cars that were at Bovington did you have any formal introduction to?
No, none, absolutely none. I'm not even sure. I think probably at that time all the tanks which had been in France had been evacuated to Bovington. And the whole of that slope on the west side of the road running up to Clouds Hill was filled with hundreds and hundreds of tanks. I remember finding a finger in one of the lockers walking around there. They were being cut up by an oxyacetylene flame. I can't remember about the armoured cars. I think the Austin cars, which the 17th Tank Battalion took to the Rhine in 1918. They'd all been shipped over to Ireland, and in Ireland were armored car companies. They were part of the 17th Tank Battalion in those days. But there were none, as far as I remember, there was no armored car instruction of any kind involving, nor was there any opportunity of driving an armored car. Looking back, we complained about this. Nobody was really frankly interested about an isolated armored car company, which anyhow was going to Palestine, and who the hell cared what happened to it? It was very large, the atmosphere. And our real work started actually in Alexandria.
Who were the personalities at Bovington when you went there for the first time? Do any stick in your mind?
Oh, I can give very good names, yes, because Hankey was the Colonel Commandant. It was a rank in those days. Colonel Commandant Hankey was commanding the Bovington. Colonel Woods, who later became Records, Colonel McClintock, who was commanding the 3rd Battalion, who was next cavalryman. Colonel Fernie was then commanding the 5th Tanks. Who was Fitzmaurice, who was the adjutant of the 3rd Battalion, which my armored car company were attached, who was killed commanding either the 4th or the 7th Tanks in France in 1939.
Who were... Did any of these characters make any strong impression upon youngsters at your level?
No. No, not really. Well, one knew them. We talked to them occasionally. There was never any. There was never any deliberate attempt to bring on young officers, which is a very curious gap looking back on it. In fact, really, you can say that in the 1920 period, thought in Bovington was at a pretty low ebb. I remember it was a Colonel Hudson who was commanding a workshop training battalion. His adjutant, whose name was Hilborn. There were three or four engineer officers. In those days, one used to have engineer officers who were really the same as the technical adjutant, only they had engineering training in civil life. And they were part of the workshop training battalion, whose job was to train fitters for the tank battalions.
Wasn't there any sense at all of, well, you're in the tank corps now, chaps, a sort of, you know, developing of a sense of corps identity?
Not to the stage that one was conscious of. I referred earlier on, there was a general sort of lack of purpose. People took the trouble to get their own battalions up to a certain standard. I think men achieved a great deal of pride over athletic prowess and that sort of thing. We had, of course, the most wonderful boxing team in those days with inter-service boxing champions serving in the ranks. One wasn't really conscious of what was going on much in Bovington itself. Occasionally we saw tanks moving and that sort of thing, but we were preoccupied trying to get ourselves organized as a company to get the men to do drill, which was entirely strange for us, you see, because in those days the tank corps used the old dismounted cavalry drill, and there were the cries and that sort of thing were entirely strange to people like myself who come from infantry regiments. And it wasn't, as I say, we really made no progress at all until we got out to Egypt.
Mm. Well, tell me about progress once you did get out to Egypt. What was your sort of induction on arrival?
We picked up some machine gun, some officers within the machine gun corps, and both the Vickers guns and Lewis guns were made available to us, and one really began to get down then to that training. Three or four Rolls-Royce cars were made available, as far as I was concerned, the section that I was in the afternoons, instead of sleeping, which I didn't much want to do, I had a corporal called Wheeler, I remember him well, who'd been in the light armoured motor batteries who we were going to take over from. And I stopped him sleeping in the afternoon. He jolly took me out and taught me to drive. And by Jove, you were taught to drive too. There were no batteries, so that you had to start a Rolls-Royce by hand between the armoured shutters and the big engine, temperature of close on 86 to 90 and very humid. You learnt very quickly. By the time you'd stopped an engine, you'd be made to get out and swing it in the heat. You didn't stop it twice. And by the time we went up to Palestine, I at least could manoeuvre a Rolls-Royce about. I'd become an expert machine gunner, and I had a lot of soldiers who were jolly good on a machine gun, jolly good revolver shots, who were self-reliant and willing and capable and tidy, it's so stupid to think of it these days. They were all taught semaphore, the most vile and blasted alphabet to read that I think I've ever found out. I found the greatest difficulty in. Taught them a certain amount of Morse, taught them map reading. And from time to time we did occasional sort of standbys, either mounted in lorries or on foot. In Alexandria, which was rioting quite continuously then. And ferreting up. And then after about a couple of months there, we went up to Palestine.
You've mentioned how you learned to drive, which was purely of your own initiative. Was there no formal training with the cars at all?
Yes, there was. There was in the mornings. Certain soldiers who had what appeared to be some mechanical aptitude were taught to drive a car. But had we not taken over some of the old LAM personnel in Palestine, we should have been in a very difficult position, for a time, anyhow. And we also had, in addition to the Rolls Arms, we had two, the company was organized in four sections. Two of those were Rolls, and the other two were known, officially known as light car patrols, and they were armed with Model T Fords, with a very cut-down box body on the back, a single king post at the back on which was mounted a Lewis gun. I'd forgotten we'd also received instruction in Lewis guns. But from that point of view, from the gunnery side, you were jolly well off. We went up to Palestine and...
Before we go on to Palestine, just keeping you in Alexandria for a while... What about training with the gun in the car?
Well, practically nothing, really, until such time as we got our full complement of cars. I certainly never fired a gun from a car in Alexandria, although we fired a great deal from the guns on tripods. Jumping a bit, we came down again to refit the cars at Christmas to Alexandria, and there on Christmas Eve I ran into a sergeant of the Black Watch who'd been transferred to the Ordnance, and he said to me if I'd like to come and see him at the Ordnance depot, he might have something which would be of some use to me. And what was of use to me was five spare Vickers guns and 10 barrels, nearly a million rounds of ammunition, some of it belted and some of it unbelted, and enough spare parts to keep us busy out of the hands of the auditors weeks and weeks. And when we came back here, we fired until really I had almost the best section of machine gunners that I've ever even seen in my life.
You mentioned that you had training in Morse. Did you have WT equipment on the cars?
No, none. Absolutely none.
What was the point of that then?
Well, there was lamp and flag. You see, a lot of they were both in use in those days. We even had heliographs. We went through all the drill of training chaps to set up heliographs at working stations. this all seemed slightly pointless to me, I must say. It was very good from the point of view. It kept our training program organized, it kept the soldiers busy and amused. And it was obviously good for them because it sharpened up their intellects and their own as well.
Mm.
But nobody knew what sort of conditions we were going to meet in Palestine, and nobody quite knew what sort of training you ought to give your soldiers.
Yes.
That's really the answer.
Did you use the cars in anger in Alexandria?
No. We had too few. There were one or two. Just switch that off for a second, will you? The general quality of officer was not high, and the leadership in both our armour car company and three, which were going to stay in Egypt, was lamentable in the last degree. One picked up what you could. We had some keen officers, captains and that sort of thing, who were concerned to see that a certain amount of work was done, the training program was coming out. But as far as inspiring leadership was concerned, the word just meant absolutely nothing to either of those two armoured car companies. And consequently, you were left rather on your own. If you began to be uneasy when you thought about the standard of your own training and the standard of training of your own men, then you got on with it. And of course, it was like a cumulative mountain. As you started, as you got one thing going and saw the soldiers brighten up because they were learning something, then your mind began to think about something else for them to do. And so you built up a very considerable esprit de corps within the sections, anyhow. Within the company, no, because there was no leadership at the top. The chap who was in command of the company went home. But the general quality of officer was jolly low, and their behaviour was extremely bad. They drank too much, they were idle. They didn't comport themselves as officers. That's really half the trouble.
That would be
and
a lie.
My section commander completed the whole thing by striking a private soldier on Christmas Eve of another regiment when drunk. And we had a hell of a job because he was then, this was later on when we came back to Alexandra. I and the other chap in the section were responsible for guarding him under close arrest for months and months and months.
Mm.
And then after that, he a clever lawyer got him off and he built that, he didn't pay the bill, was eventually kicked out for being blind drunk on picket duty in Ireland.
Well, this would be a liability in any regiment. It must have been doubly so in a struggling new one.
Well, you see, this is the point of it. Now, this is the thing. People say to me very often, well, don't you regret having lost a black watch of your own free will? But then when you think of, well, what we started from, what we've made it now, it's a very satisfactory and substantial reward.
Well, it was an adventure, wasn't it? It was a pioneering
activity. It was an adventure. It was an adventure. It was a challenge. It, somehow or other, these inadequate, idle, useless officers, really the answer, who were brakes on the wheels of human progress, had to be broken down. And there were some jolly good chaps. Who were an enormous help to me personally, and to other young in the company. But out of 16 of us, there were two of my seniority that is just out of the egg, and all the others were sort of hard-bitten chaps of 35 and 40, many of them promoted from the ranks with 18 and 19 years' service, perfectly prepared to teach you all the evil tricks of the army. But to whom appeal the normal appeals to make the show work and that sort of thing, because it was the army and that sort of thing, fell on very stony ground.
Mm. Well, it sounds then from what you say that the real work of the company only began when you went up to Palestine. How were things organised there? Where were you based and what was the setup?
There were four sections in all. There was one light car patrol at Sumac, which is at the southern end of the Sea of Galilee.
S-U-M-A-T?
No, S-E-M-A-K-H. It's just where the Jordan runs out of the Sea of Galilee. There was another one at Jenin. This was a rail section. This was the one that I went to. And that was based at the southern edge of the Great Plain, the plain that runs Palestine, really. If you go from Haifa, it runs from Haifa to Nazareth down to the Sea of Galilee, and below that is a Great Plain, and then the sort of mid-rib of Palestine, which runs from Jenin old to Nablus, to a place called Nablus, sort of more or less east and west, rose behind it. So it looked out over this big plain, which is actually the plain of Megiddo, as far as I remember. There was a light car patrol in Hebron, I think that was right, might have been Gaza, and there was another rail section in Jerusalem. And really, the country was divided between North and South Palestine. You had a brigadier commanding in the North, who was based at Jenin. His name was Green. He was an Indian cavalry brigadier. He was a jolly good chap, too. And then there was another one based in Jerusalem, and the divisional headquarters were in Jerusalem. Who the divisional headquarters was, I can't remember. I do remember General Plumer, who I think at that time was commanding either Palestine or Middle East, I think Middle East. And I think that he came up to Palestine. I remember seeing him. Because we wrecked the demonstration maneuvers, which were being held for his benefit, by finding a way up a hillside, which they thought no armored car could arrive, and entirely spoiling the battle by getting there 3/4 hour too soon.
Now, your own armored car company, tell me a bit about the routine operations after you joined the unit, both the training and the operational work.
Well, the training, of course, your first training really was devoted to getting the cars fit, which was one thing, and finding enough drivers and teaching the drivers to handle the cars properly. It was very difficult because they were in very, very bad shape, the cars. They had been, we had some of the cars which the Duke of Westminster had in 1916 when he did the Tara operation. They'd been sent out with 6 months' spells from Rolls-Royces, and we were still running on those, and that was about 4 years afterwards, 5 years afterwards. Anybody who wanted anything got hold of a Rolls, took the turret off, and charged all over the place. And the result was both the engines and the cars themselves were in a pretty disgusting state. It was possible to make them go. And I think probably the effort of getting those cars going, and there wasn't a great deal of knowledge about it. I wrote to Rolls-Royce and I got a handbook, which in those days cost a guinea, a Rolls-Royce Silver Ghost handbook. And I can remember studying that with my car commanders and drivers and the fitters we had in the section. And somehow out of that lot we got the cars going. Badly hampered by tyres. Tyres were quite appalling. But still, we could get enough tyres, and you could drive fairly regularly, and we did get to the stage where we had, I think, probably a driver and a half for the seven cars we had. That was four Rolls-Royce cars and three Rolls-Royce tenders. And while we were very largely dependent on your own wits, I mean, there was no guide to tell you what the hell happened. First patrol I went out on, I remember I went from Jenin to Sumac, and I was due to go round towards Nazareth and then come home. I always remember coming out over the hills and looking down the Sea of Galilee, with the flowers still out before the sun had really baked. One of the most lovely sights I've ever seen in my life. We went on, we finished that patrol. we had to arrange. We picked up an Indian officer of the Central India Horse, who were then stationed at Samak. And he and I had to patrol the same sort of area. This was very, very difficult, because he could speak no English and I could speak no Urdu. So we compromised on my schoolboy French, and him on the French that he'd learnt when he was serving in France. However, somehow or other, we managed to make out, and we completed our patrol, returning to drive home. And quite suddenly, the armoured car that I was travelling in, the track broke, the actual track in the hillside, and the car fell over on its side. And we sorted ourselves out and looked at this blasted 4 tons of steel. And fortunately, there was a railway station fairly nearby, and so we sent to that. We borrowed some Tanjai jacks, which you've probably never seen, which it looked like an oversized cider flagon, and out of where the cork was, there was a long thread and a head, and you just barred it round with crowbars. We borrowed 3 or 4 of those, and with great difficulty we got the car up on its wheels again, making up the track with steepers and so on. I told the driver, I remember him well, his name was Brierley, he'd been a London General Omnibus driver and then been in the Lambs and then come on to us to start the engine. He started it, put the thing in gear, and nothing happened. And we tried all the gears and nothing happened. He said, I think we've broken the half shaft. So looking very wise, I said, probably so. I went off to telephone to Jerusalem and said, send a half shaft and a fitter because I'm stuck. Or some 2.5-3 hours later arrived a Ford car with a driver and a large chunk of metal, which I presumed was the half shaft. And I said, where's the fitter? He said, I don't know anything about a fitter, sir. So I went back to the telephone, and the answer came back, put the half shaft in, or bloody well stay where you are. And so, believe it or not, we took the half shaft out, we took the axle off the rolls. I think there are 108 nuts on the back axle. We took it to pieces and put the half shaft in, and mercifully it was the right one, and drove the car home. It finished its tour with the company with that half shaft still in place. I only tell that story because those were the sort of conditions that you were up against. I mean, nobody helped you unless you helped yourself. And an ordinary section took a silver ghost engine to pieces and decarbonized it, put it back again. It ran after that too. We devoted a lot of thought, of course, to armor car tactics. And this was a very difficult business because Palestine, a lot of that part of Palestine is very rocky. There wasn't room to turn the cars. One was continually up against the problem of what the hell did you do if you encountered an enemy. We tried one time, we reversed a rolls car for 3.5 weeks, it was 3.5 miles, and the driver was in hospital for 3.5 weeks with a twisted back. And by the end of it, we couldn't get the damn thing out of reverse because the eccentric push, which brings the reverse pinion up, had seized. So that wasn't any good. And slowly, I suppose, we began to evolve our own ideas about fire and movement and the handling of the section in some sort of fashion.
What sort of ideas?
Principally, trying to instill into the soldier that the problems involved in an advance of not moving until the chap behind was ready to cover your advance, and the action which you took if you did encounter an enemy, the ordinary elementary stuff which one does over and over again. Nothing was ever written down. This was all done by word of mouth. It became a sort of tradition, a habit in the actual section or company itself. It worked. It worked to an extent. I think if we have ever come up against any opposition, I think we should have given a reasonable account of ourselves. Although, compared with later experiences, in the second battalion under Hogarth, where I saw battle drill first evolve. The comparison is absolutely ludicrous. Mm.